about the earth, really talk about survival. We could talk about the poles where the cold is unrivaled. The Arctic top of the world got people and polar bears. Antarctica, crazy penguins chilling down there on miles and miles of ice and glaciers. But something ain't straight with our polar neighbors. It's a change in the climate, a change in the weather. It's heating up now, but it's not for the better. See, the heat comes down from the sun to the earth, but now the heat can't escape, it just can't disperse because of carbon dioxide from power plants and factories, causing trucks so much more than you could find naturally. So the poles get warm and the earth gets hotter. All that necessary ice melts down into water. And the impact, the sad fact is it can only escalate. So for real, we gotta act now before it's too late.
Take aim at climate change.
You gotta take aim, yo.
Take aim at climate change.
Take
aim at climate change. Take aim at climate change.
Man, why should I care what's going on there?
See, that's the catch. It's not all that obvious, but changes in the north and south are gonna affect all of us. That's why we got polar adventurers. Measure the thickness of the ice and checking the earth's temperatures. We're life, that ice is the earth's refrigerator. But when it starts to melt, it will be felt at the equator. Peak, when glaciers melt, the oceans start swelling. And then they flood the coast where the people be dwelling. You could say peace to Florida, New York, and California, all drowning in the ocean.
Don't say we didn't warn you.
Real, all it takes is a couple degrees before floods, droughts, and hurricanes are not anomalies.
And all these catastrophes become our new realities, coming down on the world just like the sword of Damocles.
Take aim at climate change.
Gotta all work together.
Take aim at climate change. Take aim at climate change.
Gotta all work together.
Take aim at climate change.
Okay, I get it, but give me some credit. So the world needs rescue. What can I do?
Just one small positive act and then another, and then add them all together, one after the other. Come on, you know the drill. It's about conservation, using only what you need and making sure that you're not wasting. Lots of information can be found on the web, so educate your head and don't forget to let your knowledge spread.
Is that all?
Not even close, that's not the end of it, but a million small things can produce immense benefits. Any way you call it, there's no single way to solve it. We gotta have involvement before the earth becomes insolvent.
Adapt to a new situation. Innovate, use your imagination. Mitigate, we've got to try.
Discoveries and new questions to ask, cause we can figure out the future by examining the past. So we sail to the poles and sample the extremes, and drill into the ice and discover what it means. So use that brain and make science a priority, and you can work on stopping global warming with authority. So act now, there's no time for games. It's time to take aim.
Mitigate, we've got to try to stop global warming. We've got to aim.
Welcome, and thank you for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program is Lawrence Lessig interviews Jack Abramoff. Jack Abramoff is the former lobbyist who pleaded guilty in 2006 to charges of fraud, tax evasion, and conspiracy to bribe public officials. He's also worked as a businessman, movie producer, and writer. Abramoff's lobbying and the scandals and investigations are featured in a documentary movie, Casino Jack and the United States of Money, and in a political satire movie titled Casino Jack. Lawrence Lessig is a law professor at Harvard. He has been the lead counsel in important cases concerning copyright laws for digital content. His current work concerns institutional corruption. So take it away, Lawrence.
Right here.
Hi, I'm Tom Ferguson. I was actually on NPR with you a couple weeks ago on the program on insider trading. I teach at UMass Boston. I just want to ask you about the analytics of this. I mean, it's a very interesting discussion, but a lot of folks who've tried to understand the logic of lobbying have had trouble trying to trace it through when they think about exactly how does a congressman or woman price the services they're doing. I ask because when you look at sort of what's paid and for what they get, you get some odd cases like maybe you might sell, I'm going to make it up, 6% of the defense budget one night for $200,000, and then a week later somebody will contribute $1 million and get just a gambling resort or something like that. I mean, could you shed some light on the process under what you might call the price? I know you're a libertarian, so you must, in the tradition of libertarianism in the United States, they love the price system. You must understand what my question's point is. I'd be quite grateful for any insight you could shed on that.
Well, I don't think there's a rational answer to the question. It's a good question. But my experience is that those members of Congress, which was most of them, who are into raising money and trying to not necessarily do what they would consider to be an illegal quid pro quo, but in essence a quid pro quo, they're just trying to get as much money for anything they do, no matter what it is. And so if $1 million is available, they're going to try to get $1 million. If $100,000 is available, they're going to try to do that. So I'm not certain that if I understood the question correctly, but I don't know that there's necessarily a rationale here. It's more of a Congress fears not being reelected and not getting not advancing in the system and not being able to become a committee chairperson. And so money is the oil that makes that engine go, and they're going to try to get whatever they can get. So I don't know that there's necessarily a pricing system. There wasn't with us. I mean, so I'm unaware.
But let me push a little bit more on the question. Mm-hmm. It's a very good question. It's been, you know, it's one of the puzzles at the center of whether money is actually corrupting the system. And one form of it is the price is so low. You know, you in your your book talk about the return on investment that you got from lobbying. You know, you said your clients, you got them 80,000, I can't remember the number, some huge percentage return on investment. And the economists would say, well, how is that possible? Why doesn't the system just bid the price up so that the return is something like a market return? Like, why is it so irrational? Why doesn't the government hold out for more, right, so that they demand, you know, that I get, if I'm going to get $1 billion subsidy, which the sugar people get because of the tariffs, $1 billion subsidy, you should have to pay, you lobbyists, more than just, you know, $1 million for that. You should be paying $500 million for that $1 billion subsidy. Why doesn't it work like that?
Because they're dealing in stolen goods.
Stolen goods.
Yeah, I mean, in essence, this isn't a normal business. They're dealing in stolen goods. They're taking things out of the public trust and selling them. So you're not going to get a lot of Duke Cunninghams with a price chart.
Too bad.
There are these guys, yeah.
Okay, Abby?
Hi, I'm Abby Brown. I'm a fellow at the center. I'm wondering if you can walk us through, presumably there are some idealists who get elected to Congress still, who go there with some public interest in mind. Can you walk us through how you go about corrupting them? What's the rhetoric of that conversation? How do you reel them in and so forth?
When a member of Congress, a new member of Congress, shows up in Washington these days, the first thing they meet is not the lobbyists. They meet their leadership, and their leadership introduces them to the lobbyists in the following way. They say that you're a new member of Congress, and the most important thing for you is to get reelected next time. Because if we lose your seat, then we're going to have to fight and get it back the time after that. So since that's the most important thing, and since most of them, 80% of them, come with debt, the first thing we're going to have you do is you've got to retire your debt. And now we're talking about before the Congress is even convened. We're talking about in December after the November election. And here's a group of people who are very good at helping you retire your debt. Meet the lobbyists. And that's where it starts. And even if they're the best folks in the world and they have the most, the greatest aims, and by the way, some of them will say, look, I have just no interest. I'm not going to take any lobbyist money. I'm not going to get involved in that the first year and maybe in the second year. But when they're there 20 years, even if they think they're, you know, I'm taking the campaign contribution, I'm going to take that $2,000, but I don't sell my vote for $2,000. They're wrong. They sell their vote for a glass of water, not consciously, but they're human beings. And if somebody does something for you and you're a decent person, what is the thing you're going to think in your mind? Gee, that person did something nice for me. Now, you can either be a jerk and just say, I hate them. So if you do something nice for me, I hate you. And a lot of parents complain that sometimes kids act like that. Or you can be a decent person. Well, gee, I can't give him that, but I'm going to root for him. Or I can't do that, but maybe I could do this. That's how it starts. It is not a moment where somebody walks into Bob Ney and gives him $50,000 in casino chips. That is very rare. What I just described to you is virtually everybody. And it's just a matter of time before they are beholden to the lobbyists at one level or another.
David? Mr. Abramwell, thank you very much for being here. My name is David Korn. I'm a professor of pathology at the medical school, the Harvard Medical School. There's probably a lot of agreement in this room, certainly, that the root of evil is the money, right? That's what you're saying. But if a miracle were to happen and there was legislation passed, as some have been trying to do for a very long time, to make the system a publicly funded system and get rid of some of the temptation, don't you think that the Supreme Court would rule it a First Amendment violation and overturn the legislation? In other words, there seems to be a hopelessness about the road to a solution for a problem that a cause of which is very generally understood and accepted. How do you get rid of it?
Well, there's an interesting case in North Carolina right now that just the Fourth Circuit has affirmed, which bans lobbyist contributions in North Carolina. And it'll be very interesting to see where that goes. But somebody who chooses path A, you know, the rights aren't taken away. They're making a choice to engage in lobbying or engage in getting money out of the public till or whatever they're doing. For them to forego a right, we do have that, you know, in society. And it seems that that case in North Carolina may wind up being a seminal case in this regard. And it does bring hope that, obviously, if the Supreme Court knocks it down or says that that's not going to work, we're going to have to go back and look at other remedies. There are ways around the Supreme Court, too. Okay, they're difficult. They're constitutional amendments, and they're very, very, they're impossible. When's the last time the Constitution was amended? I would venture to say most of the people in the room weren't born yet. So it's a difficult process, but I think that there is an opening here to go after it. We'll see what happens.
But David was asking about public funding, which you, for a moment, opened your eyes to, but then now you've shut this down again.
Well, I
want to push you a little bit more on this, because again, what you're talking about is limits, ways to limit people from participating. And you can't really, in the heart of your heart of hearts, believe. I mean, you might have a very accurate political judgment about the likelihood of public funding. But you can't, in your heart of hearts, really believe that if all we do is limit, the wealthiest 1% won't just find another way around the system to exert their influence inside the system, right?
So, well, look, first of all, if things are drawn tightly, I can tell you I sat in prison with a bunch of guys who tried to work their way around the system, okay? And they were convicted and prosecuted and thrown in prison. So I don't want, you know, if you've been to prison, you don't want anybody to ever go to prison, and I don't want to see people in prison. But if that's the penalty for playing games, you're going to get rid of a lot of it there, too. But let me tell you why I'm against public funding, among other reasons. First of all, I'm a conservative. I am libertarian-type conservative. So,
who wants to silence a bunch of speakers?
Well, I mean, I want to silence if they make a choice. I'm giving them the choice. Nobody's forcing anybody to be a lobbyist. I wasn't forced to be a lobbyist, you know, and if people make a choice, I think that they, like in all things in life, you give up certain things if you choose other things. But in terms of public funding, look, I have a distrust of the government, I have to be honest with you, and not needless to say I have a distrust of the government after what I've been through just in the last period of time. You know, they say that a conservative is a liberal who is mugged. Well, a libertarian is a conservative who is indicted, okay? And so I lived in complete government control, so maybe that does influence my thinking a little more than others. I don't, and I'm not trying to disparage everybody who works for the government, surely not, but generally I don't like the idea of putting in the hands of people power to make decisions.
Right, okay, but then vouchers don't do that.
Okay,
right?
Yeah, I said the voucher thing, actually, I was much more open to in terms of, from my own philosophical you know, point of view. When I read your book, I thought that was a much more, the Grant and
Franklin
approach, that would be something much more, I'd be personally as a conservative much more amenable to. And I think it's very important, we talked briefly before, to get this stuff fixed, we're going to have to find something that people on the right and people on the left are going to be able to agree to and to overcome the kind of bitter political divide that's in this country. It's something that both sides can get a hold of, and I think that might be one way to do it.
Thank you. So I'm Jeff Bridges. I'm a student at the Divinity School. Before I was there, though, I worked in politics for about 10 years, and it really just completely sucked my soul dry, and I think you understand. And so coming here and going to Divinity School, and I got involved with Occupy Harvard, and it's really been a redemptive experience for me. And I came here tonight thinking, oh, this is Jack Abramoff. He's writing a book to make money, and now he's trying to sell it to Harvard students. Naturally, that's just what the guy's doing. That's what you do. You write a book. Something bad happens, you write a book. But then when you were talking about your experience of being arrested and reflecting on how you operated as a lobbyist, it really spoke to me, and I believe you. I buy it. I want to know why you're doing what you're doing right now. What do you hope to accomplish with the path you've chosen now?
Well, I mean, as I said, what I want to do is I've got some role to play in solving this problem. It's a problem. I've come to recognize it as a problem. I mean, you all recognize it intuitively. I'm ashamed that I didn't. Okay, but I didn't. And not only didn't I recognize it, I was in it. And not only was I in it, I might have led it. All right, but okay, that was pre-lapsarian at this point. So what I'm doing now is, as hard as it is, by the way, it's not easy to sit here and say the things I'm saying to you all. I mean, you know, it's just not. And you're not the only ones I'm saying it to. And I've said it in front of big TV audiences. And I got to believe in their heart of hearts, my family probably wishes I wouldn't say it, although they've been nothing but encouraging, because they also see that this is not a system. Look, none of my kids, you know, I was very political. My wife worked for the Republican National Committee. We were both political junkies. Not one of my children, well, one of my children is joining the College Republicans, but not one of my kids wants anything to do with American politics, not just because of what happened to us, because they see that it's just utterly hopeless. They think it's utterly hopeless and worthless. So I think just even for them, I want to do something to try to move the ball forward. I'm not going to do it by myself. Frankly, I wish I were back in the position. I wish I came to this while I was where I was. You know, when I sat in prison, you know, when you're in prison, all you're thinking about is, how do I get out of here? How do I get out of here? Even an hour earlier, just please, God, get me out of here. It's just impossible to describe what it's like. 24 hours a day, people screaming. You know, we lived six men to a 150-square-foot space. It's just a nightmare. So you're thinking every minute, how do I get out of here? So what was I thinking? Of course, I was thinking, darn, why didn't I think of this when I was a lobbyist? I could have had the laws changed, all right, and figured some way to have gotten me out of here if this had happened. Well, obviously, that's silly. But I do often sit back and think, you know, what if I still was in that game? Boy, I could really do some damage if I was in there, and it occurred to me what has occurred to me in a sense. Obviously, I'm not there, and I can't. So what I can do is I can speak about it, and I can tell people what went on, and I wrote about it. And, you know, I have a book out. I have a $44 million restitution order. This book would have to outsell the Bible for me to see any, you know, any money. And I didn't do it to make money. And the industry, anyway, as everybody who writes books knows, you know, is in terrible shape. You know, people aren't making, unless you're, you know, Rawlings or whoever, you're not making a lot of money. I did it because I think it's vital people know. And if they know, maybe they'll get angry. And if they get angry, maybe they'll do something. And maybe this great country, and it is a great country, and a great people, will rise up and try to get something changed. That's why I did it.
So we have last question. So make it really, really good.
A lot of pressure now. Mm-hmm. My name is Howard Melman. You were saying before when telling when your story broke, how you were in denial and you were just in a different world. And I immediately wondered, do you think that politicians and staffers are equally in denial and in that different world?
Yes, they're absolutely. not only are they not recognizing what is being now become clear to me and has been clear to all of you from the beginning, but think about folks who can go around trading on insider information and buying stock on the one hand, and then reading the paper that Raj Rajaratnam gets sent away for 11 years, and they're doing exactly the same thing, if not worse, than he did. And they not only don't feel bad about it, they feel good about it. So, and they don't understand. And these same guys, and by the way, I do talk to congressmen still. They're quiet about it. Obviously, no congressman wants it in the paper. They're talking to me. But they don't get it. Why is it that we're so unpopular? Why is it that 9% approval rating? How is that possible that Obama has a better approval rating than we do? Are you kidding? Are you kidding? That's the world they live in. They don't live in, unfortunately, they totally disassociate themselves from a reality that everybody else intuitively sees. And by the way, as did I in those days. So I understand it, but I feel bad for them in a certain respect, you know.
So Jack Abramoff, thank you for coming.
All right.
This little song that I'm saying about people you know is true. If you black and gotta work for a living now, this is what they would say to you. This is, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, just take a round. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. I was in a place one night, they were all having fun. They was all buying beer and wine, but they would not sell me none. They said, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, you'd stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. They went to an employment office, the number that I got in line. They called everybody's number, but they never did call mine. They said, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. Me and a man was working side by side. This is what it meant. They was paying him $1 an hour, and they was paying me 50 cents. I said, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. I hope built this country, and I fought for it too. Now I guess that you can see what a black man have to do. He says, if you was white, she's all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. I hope win sweet victory with my little plying hoe. Now I want you to tell me, brother, what you're gonna do about the old Jim Crow. Now if you's white, she's all right. If you's brown, stick around. But if you's black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back.
You can hear great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org. Or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Way down, way down.
I blaze the river where old mill run. Meet the lazy river with the noonday sun. Linger in the shade of a kind old tree.
Throw away your troubles, dream a dream of me, dream a dream of me.
Up the lazy river where the robin's on. wakes to bright new morning as we loaf along. Blue skies up above, everyone in love. Off the lazy river, how happy we will be. Mama, mama. Oh, up the lazy river, up the lazy river, oh, you dog. Boy, if I ain't ripping this evening, I hope something. Oh, the lazy river. River. Oh, you river. Oh, you dog. Oh, you river. Look out there, Charles Alexander. Swing out there when he marries that boy.
That's all, folks.